Okay, fantastic. We are recording right now. So this is Bio 241, and it's the first session that we're going to have. So this is January 20th. It's Thursday. So we got one lecture this week. My name is Dr. Gober. I sent everybody a syllabus by email. It's also in Blackboard if you want a copy. And then I made a hard copy for everybody that's in class. If you want a hard copy, all right, just grab one as we pass it up to the back of the room. If you don't want another copy, that's fine. Just kind of spread it right and left and pass it to the back of the class. Okay. So the syllabus has really important information, nice contact information that you might find helpful. And so it has a grade scale in there, just a 90-80-70 grade scale. The schedule, you'll see when your tests are. You have a lab quiz every week and sometimes maybe two lab quizzes because you're going to get a couple extra credit lab quizzes, and you'll have the usual one on top of that. And the other thing that people received as an email is the welcome letter. And the welcome letter tells you how to log on to Blackboard, which is the virtual classroom. So you got to log on to Blackboard. Those of you that have just registered today because we're replacing no-shows that come to class, that's how you get an ad code to enter the classes when there's a no-show in a lab. Then I'll give you a welcome letter that tells you how to log on to Blackboard. But that is the big goal for you this week, right, is to make sure that you can log on to Blackboard. So you have to have your Cypress College ID and your My Gateway password usually works. There's usually one or two students where it doesn't work. Okay, don't get frustrated because your password is located in a different program compared to Blackboard, and if that program, the banner program, doesn't handshake with Blackboard just right, then the password gets lost or corrupted. But that's okay. I can change it to student, and then you can log in and then change it back in your personal information in Blackboard to whatever password you'd like. So it's really pretty easy to do that. All right, people that are just registering today, it'll probably take maybe about 12 hours or so, maybe overnight, to have your information passed into Blackboard, and you can log on the next day. Or maybe if you register in the morning, you can get on at night, but probably not that same morning. So it takes just a little while to do that. So I'm going to log on to Blackboard right now, right here. And we'll just mouse around a little bit. I want to show you some things on Blackboard so you can get started over the weekend if you haven't looked already. So here is your student ID starting with that funny symbol, the ampersand, right? And all of the numbers of your student number have to be placed in here like that. And then your My Gateway password goes in, and you should then log in. Now, also in the welcome letter is the URL for that login page, and I would save that URL exactly. So it's just cypresscollege.blackboard.com, and put it into your favorites or bookmarks or something and enter it directly. There is a link in My Gateway, but sometimes it's problematic. Sometimes the features don't transfer over correctly. So it's best for you to directly log in and not use the Cypress College website to do that. All right, so there's some announcements in the center area. And over on the right-hand side shows you your courses that you're taking that have web content in Blackboard. So you might be taking more than one class, like I am, that has web content right here. So let's see, we're close to, here's one for this semester, all these right here. This is good. All right, so let's look at this website. So it pops up, and we got some graphics in the banner up over here. The left-hand frames over here have some just outlines of information that you want to be looking at. So announcements during the semester, I'll put important information here, like say, don't forget to study this figure for an exam, or I forgot to mention something in class, or, ooh, watch out, we rescheduled an exam, right? So important information on the fly we put into the announcement area right here. The course syllabus is under this button, and most of the information I have in a PDF file, so you need a PDF reader to look at this, and a lot of pages I put the link for Adobe to get a PDF reader if you don't have one on your computer already, but that's a free download, it's a free plugin. we'll be talking about various plugins during the semester. All right, so there's the syllabus. Course information, I think, has the syllabus once again. It's got the welcome letter. It also has a weekly study plan that you should download and look at and work with your lab instructor, all right, so that you can look at the time management issues that you might have so that you can find the correct times to study so that you can get the grade that you want in this class. All right, so you do have to prepare typically in a college-level class. For every hour in class that you spend, you have to spend 3 hours outside studying. That's just, you know, kind of across the board. More rigorous classes, depending on your background, will require more than 3 hours. All right, so probably before a test, you'll be spending more than 3 hours for every hour in lecture. And then here are just some links for various plugins that you might need. There are videos in Blackboard that you can watch, and Windows Media Player works pretty well. But there are a lot of recent updates to Windows Media Player. I went back and I think I was using Windows Media Player 5 and they're on version 12 right now. So maybe the first thing you want to do, if that's the video viewer that you're going to use, get all the recent updates so that you can get both the video and the audio together at the same time and justified in time, right? If you're using an old Windows Media Player, you might get the audio track but not the video, which is kind of disappointing, or the video and no audio, right? And that's no fun either. So update these things. Okay, course documents. This is a good area for you to go to. I have my lecture PowerPoints right here that you can download if you wish, print them out beforehand, and if you don't have a PowerPoint program on your computer, there's also a free viewer from Microsoft, a plugin that you can get to view the PowerPoints, and you can print them out. You just can't do some fancy manipulation with them. When I print my PowerPoints out for class, for instance, I like to print them out just like that. Not four per page. You might want to just kind of hold it up so people can see behind you. Yeah, four on a page, right? And I turn color off just to save ink. If you just have the free viewer, you don't have that option. You have to print it just as it is, one per page. And some lectures might have 60 slides, so it's a little bit expensive. So if you just want to download that file to your computer, put it on your hard drive, bring your laptop to class or your notebook to class, that's fine, okay? As long as it's not too noisy, right? When you're typing, click, 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 might disturb some students. All right, so how would you download this PowerPoint lecture to your hard drive so that you can access it anytime without having to go to the internet again? Most mouses, at least PCs and maybe Macintoshes do now, have two mouse buttons. The one you usually navigate with is the left-hand mouse button, and you don't usually use the right-hand one very much, but in this circumstance, you probably would. So if you use the right-hand mouse button, click on this link right here, another window will open up, and it will say Save Target As or Save Link As, and then you get to designate the location. Like, for instance, I just might say, well, let's just throw it on the desktop for right now. Okay, so this is a nice high-speed internet connection, and we've got it, and you would have it, too, for the rest of the class, right? So that's a nice way of doing that. Okay, so all of these files you can right-click to save to your hard drive if you want to. Here are the PowerPoints for the first lab that most of the lab instructors will use. Some lab instructors have other PowerPoints, but this is the one that most of the lab is based on for this first week in class. And that's the only lab that I develop PowerPoints for. So here are all the other PowerPoints that we're going to discuss for this class. Okay, so that's pretty important. What else we have right here? Here are just some things we're working on. Here is something that I think is important. Pre-lecture reading assignments. These are for no credit, okay, but if you read the chapter a little bit, skim through the chapter, and try to answer these questions before lecture, even before I say anything about it. One of the things about anatomy that you noticed, and probably you'll notice about physiology, is that there's a certain language that goes along with the class, right? So there's language skills, there's terminology, and if you come to class the first time and you hear some of these words, lecture just might go right over the top of your head. But if you've seen or heard some of those words before lecture, then the lecture really will make a lot of sense. So the pre-lecture reading assignment, I don't know why it didn't open up. Open file with, oh, maybe it's down here someplace. Here it is. Oh, it's on over here. Okay. Here it is. All right, so the pre-lecture reading assignments are pretty low level, but give you a good introduction to the material so that you can appreciate the lecture for the first time. Like, be able to define physiology, for instance, and something about scientific method. And if you do that, then you'll have a lot more fun in lecture. And if there's something that you don't understand in this pre-lecture reading assignment or something in the chapter, then you can ask me during class, which is perfect, right? Then that sets you up for success and not just kind of being befuddled about some kind of concept in a chapter. So every lecture will have a pre-lecture reading assignment, and of course you have to fill it in. And then after lecture, they should magically appear as a key, right? So if we go back over here, then here are the pre-lecture reading assignment keys, and you can see how I think, and that's probably a really good idea because you might have a right answer to put in here, or maybe 90% right or 80% right, but since I'm the one that's writing the test, you probably want to know exactly how I think about a certain issue, right? So these give you really good feedback on what you should be learning. Yeah. Well, there's one for every lecture. So if you want to download all of them at one shot, that's good, and put them into a nice file in your computer, pre-lecture reading assignments in a 241 folder, for instance. I'm sorry, if you want to put all of the pre-lecture reading assignments in a folder, that would be okay. Typically no. So there's only one lecture that I'm going to update, but right now the whole course pretty much is complete. Yeah, so for those PowerPoints, I probably won't change them at all. It just has to do with a little operating issue with Blackboard. Since there's actually four different classes in this particular room, that means if I change something in Blackboard, I got to do it four times. So you can see that could get out of control in a really big hurry. So the class really has to be set to go 100% when I open them all up. I just clone all of those four classes to the same file. Yeah. Okay, so pre-lecture reading assignments. And then the keys. Well, I can see them right now because I have instructor privileges. But as you can see, this item right here is not available. Will be available January 25th. That's Tuesday at 1 p.m. That's after class, right? So these will just automatically pop up for you. But I do want you to spend some time on your own digging some of that information out. Okay. So here's another area that you're going to spend some time on. This is what you have to work on the computer with. These are the weekly assignments in the computer. So this will keep you on schedule in the class. And you can see this is what you should be working on January 19th until the 26th. And a week always ends on a Wednesday night at 11 p.m. There's going to be a quiz online that you have to complete every week on Wednesday by 11 p.m., except for spring break. There's nothing for you to do on spring break. Although even if you went to Den Pasar or someplace fun, you could still take it because it's on the internet, but all right, hopefully you'll get it done ahead of time. Okay, so look, every Wednesday, 11 o'clock, and if you have a problem with your internet connection and you miss that deadline, or you have a problem with your computer and you miss that deadline, that's a shame, and that's too bad. All right, so try not to do your assignments at 10:45 on Wednesday night right before, right? Get it done ahead of time. The quizzes you can take an unlimited number of times, and there is no time limit on them, all right? So there's no reason why you can't meet this deadline, right? Okay, so we bump into this first week, and so it's going to be on Chapter 1. Here are the pages that you should be reading. These are the objectives for Chapter 1. And then we have some animations that you can look at, and there's some little quizzing activities after those animations to see if you're picking up the salient features and information contained in those videos. And these videos are short. They're maybe 4 minutes, maybe at the longest. Some of these you can download to your computer, but since they're videos, they're huge files, those you just might want to leave on the web someplace. Here are some practice quizzes, okay, for that you should look at. Not all of the quizzes in this particular online quiz bank, but maybe questions 1 through 27, all right, and 1 through 20 under this link right here. And if you practice these, that will give you some good working knowledge of the material that's covered in our textbook, and they will also help set you up to do well on the online quiz. All right, so all of these pages right here have a certain look to them compared to this little segment down over here. What do you notice on this part of the page compared to all these others right here? I don't know if these show up as separate pages or just one big long page. Since I'm looking in an instructor view, I'm not quite sure. I wanted this to just be a separate page, but it might be tucked way down on the bottom of the first page. What do you notice about this area right here compared to all of these other areas right up over here? Okay. There's one thing. You know, I'm colorblind. So if you tell me something with color, I can't really relate to it very well. So I relate to shapes and structures of things. Okay, but I can tell there's something different about the color and also something about the difference of a shape of something in this area right here. There is a dollar sign. Okay, so if you're mousing around through Blackboard in your course and you see something with an icon that's a dollar sign, that means that activity is worth course points. You don't want to forget about it. Okay, so in this class you get course points by taking lab quizzes every week, by taking the 5 lecture exams, and then by taking these weekly online quizzes. And the way you find your weekly online quiz is that you look for these dollar signs right here. Okay, so that's the key. All right, so if you do all this information, do the practice quizzes, and you're set up really well. Also, maybe the end of chapter quizzes as well could be contained in here that are in your textbook. All right, so you'll be good to go. So you can read the instructions on how to do that. Blackboard works fantastic in the morning. Okay, it starts to bog down maybe in the afternoon. And where it gets really difficult to use Blackboard, let's go back to this first page right here, is right around 10:30. Because what's everybody in the United States doing? They're taking quizzes that are due around 11 p.m., right? A lot of instructors just pick that time. That's just the way it goes. So I don't know, you can't blow through a quiz like 10 minutes before 11 o'clock because it's probably going to be too slow for you. So the other thing that I notice with the weekly schedule right here, or this the weekly assignments, is that I've activated the first 3 weeks. That's all of the information for the first test. I have not activated week 4 because that's information that will be on the second test. So when you get done with the first test, or you approach week number 4, this one will pop open and you'll be able to work on it. But nonetheless, even though I tried to make only the weeks that you're responsible for active, always look at the dates right here when you should be working on that one, okay? Because February 9th at 11 p.m., that quiz will go away. This whole area will stay open so that you can use it to study for the exam, but that quiz will go away for you. All right, so the quiz number 1 is going to go away January 26th. This will stay active until after the first test. So you can go back and practice the electronic drag and drop exercises, look at the videos or whatever. Yeah. Yes, you can. Okay. In Blackboard, there's ways to configure quizzes in different ways. Previous semesters, I only had students take a quiz once and with a time limit. And the technology really wasn't operating up to snuff, and the internet or the Blackboard server or somebody's computer would get confused and drop the connection in the middle of a quiz, maybe after taking just one question. So they would only get credit for one question. And it was not an issue of a lack of their knowledge, it was a technology issue. And there's just so many technology issues at the moment, we can't solve them all. So the format for quizzes is open book, open notes, and you can take that quiz as many times as you want until this deadline right here. And you get a score back right away, and it will tell you if you got that question right or wrong, but it won't tell you what the right answer is. So if you get a question wrong, you still have to go back and do some research. Now, you could probably take that quiz for one question, right, if there's 4 answers, and if the last answer is the correct answer, you'd have to take that quiz 4 times, right, or 3 times to get the right answer just by memory without learning anything. It's still fastest to learn material and take the quiz. And there's always going to be more than one question on a quiz, so I don't know how many permutations. It would probably take an infinity number of times to print it out until you got everyone right. So, so that's the deal. There's only one caveat to that. And that is when you are taking a quiz, at the very bottom, there's going to be a button that says Save and Submit. And that's the button I want you to take, even if you didn't answer any of the questions. You'll get a zero for that particular quiz that you're taking, but it's not going to matter. It'll be stored. But whenever you take it again, or if you've taken it previously and gotten 100% on it, the 100% score is going to be stored. If you don't hit the Save and Submit button, then Blackboard will forever think that you're taking the quiz. And if you're taking a quiz in Blackboard right now, it won't let you back in and take it. So you have to hit the Save and Submit button, otherwise Blackboard gets completely confused. So the way that you can get out of a quiz without hitting Save and Submit is by, what, just closing the window, Xing the window. Don't close the window out when you're taking a quiz. Exit a quiz by hitting that Save and Submit, even though you know you're not going to get 100% on it if you don't have time to finish it. Okay. If it hangs up like that, if you close the window, then you got to give me an email, and then I've got to decide if we're going to activate that quiz or not. Okay. So it's just kind of time-consuming for you and me if you X out of a window. Just hit Save and Submit when you're taking a quiz. And, you know, maybe everybody will do that the first couple of times, but after the first couple of weeks, you'll get the hang of how to work in here. We've got your SI information right here. I'll have to update that, but I think that's looking pretty good. Right, got some instructor information, office hours, and things like that. So that's Blackboard. Start mousing around in there. And the other thing is...
You forgot
the N in
the
Men? M-E-N?
Oh,
oh, that won't even work. Okay, okay, thank you. Yeah, I'll figure out how to make that an active link even. It's not an active link at the moment. You have to copy that and paste it someplace. Okay, so that's some background information. And the syllabus is going around. Make sure you understand that syllabus. The other thing that I like to do in class every time is pass around a sign-in sheet, which is right here for today. All right, so attendance is mandatory, and you can only miss so many lectures and labs. And it's really for your own benefit, because if you don't go to lecture and lab, what kind of grade are you going to get in the class? Well, you're going to fail the class, right? So by dropping you for non-attendance is not punitive. It's just a way to tell students that they have to come to class to do well. So go ahead and sign by your name. If you're not on that list, you're not officially registered in the class as of probably last night sometime. And then you might want to talk to me or administration and records. So just pass it all the way around. And then those people at the back row, just bring it down after lecture. All right, so let's start talking about some stuff. All right, we got about a little bit more than a half hour left to talk about some opening statements about this particular class. And great, here is the PowerPoint. Sometimes I'll be drawing on the board, sometimes I'll be using PowerPoint lectures. So it's probably very helpful for you to print these out before class. Okay. And then you can use them after class to listen to the lecture once again if you want to off that site. Okay. All right, so first some basic definitions right here, and that is of physiology. Physiology is a scientific study. Question, way in the back. You're really going to have to yell. Oh, yeah, the book. I still have a lot of confusion on the book, okay, because they came out with a new edition. They won't sell edition 11 anymore. And I got a copy of edition 12, and at the beginning of edition 12, it says what all the changes are and improvements and enhancements and things like that. And indeed, they did make those changes. Most of the changes are in the prose, the writing of the book, and not the figures. I've looked at every figure that's important, and a number of end of chapter questions that I liked, and I haven't found any changes. And so I'm not really happy that there really aren't as many improvements as I was told there were going to be, but it's mostly in the writing. And the reason why it's this is the reason why it's important to get the 12th edition, because in Blackboard, I guess I want to close this out. There's one other important area that you guys might want to start looking at this weekend, even in Blackboard. Where's Blackboard at? Right here. Course documents. Okay. Oh, no, exam study guides. Okay, so these you might want to print out right away. The study guides, this is the information that you're going to be held responsible for on the test. So it tells you exactly what chapters, again, the page numbers, the same thing in the weekly assignments button over here. But also, there are the exam figures. And the exam figures are figures in your book that I erase the labels off of, that, and then I photocopy and put on the test, and then you have to match a word bank to relabel the figures. So there's flow diagrams of physiologic concepts. It's really not anatomy anymore, okay, but it's going to be more conceptual. And in the study guide are the figure numbers. And sometimes the figure numbers don't correspond from one edition to the next. All right, so I went through the whole book, and I didn't find any difference in the figures from the 11th edition to the 12th edition. All right, and the page numbers are pretty much identical. So you can use the 11th edition, but these study guides right here have all been written for the new edition. You might find some small changes here and there. So if you make sure that, if I say the end of chapter questions 1, 5, and 10, make sure that in edition 12 that it's the exact same questions at the end of the chapter in edition 11. All right, so it's a little cumbersome to use edition 11, but I haven't found a major problem with it yet. Yeah. So there are copies of the 11th edition in the reserve section of the library, and today I'm going to put a couple copies of the 12th edition in the reserve section of the library. So you can walk into the library with your 11th edition, check out the 12th, and then just see what the correspondence is. Yeah, you can go ahead and do that. Okay. So so recently I haven't found much difference between those two. Okay. And I'm not very happy either that they changed editions without changing very much, because it takes me just about as much time to rebuild Blackboard with a new edition, even though they don't change anything, because I still have to check every single thing. Okay. So that was not by my choice to go to a new edition. All right, so start working on these things right away. Okay, so now we're ready. Here it is. Okay, before I went in here and started the program, the PowerPoint program again, I should have asked, any other questions you're good for right now? I'll try to show you some more stuff about Blackboard is next time, but I don't want to just spend the whole period talking about that. Get in there, mouse around. That's the best way to do it. Okay, so physiology is the scientific study of function. How, and in particular, since we're interested in humans in here, how your body functions. Now, there's some prerequisite to understanding how a body functions, and that means that we have to know something about anatomy, and that's why anatomy is a prerequisite for this class. Because if you change the structure of something, guess what's going to change automatically when that happens? The function is going to automatically change, right? So, as a matter of fact, if we're looking at microscopes in anatomy, and what's the best way to learn something about a microscope? Do you start with physiology or do you start with anatomy of a microscope? Yeah, with anatomy, right? You learn the pieces, what their name is, and then on top of that, you layer what the function is, then you practice using it, then you have a pretty good idea what a microscope is doing. All right, so don't forget your anatomy. I'll use a lot of anatomy in this class to describe how your body works. Pathophysiology is the study of physiology when it starts to misbehave, when it's in a disease state. And so that might mean that there's some underlying structural changes that take place to produce some misbehavior of the normal physiology. And that change in structure could be maybe a difference in the gross anatomy, and that might mean that, well, maybe instead of having a heart with four chambers, you have a heart with three chambers, with two of them interconnected. Well, that heart's not going to behave exactly the same way because the structure has changed quite a bit. All right, but there are other ways that we can look at structure. We have to look at structure even at the molecular level, even in terms of molecules. So if molecules change their shape, that's going to change the physiology that's going to happen inside of that organism. So when we think of shape, it's just not in an anatomy way. You have to think as well in terms of chemical terms or chemistry. So chemistry is important for this class. And if you're considering whether or not you want to stay in this class, you should think first, have I ever taken a college-level chemistry class? And if you haven't, then I would recommend that you do first before taking this class. If you have a little background in chemistry, okay, that's good. The only thing that's in the college catalog is high school chemistry as an advisory, all right? And we can't put in college chemistry as an advisory for various reasons, but nonetheless, I have to share that information with you. And everybody who has taken my advice has always thanked me. I haven't run into anybody that hasn't thanked me just yet. And if you're one of those people that are a little fearful just by me talking about it, okay, what does that mean? Oh, that means that you're the exact person that I'm talking to, right? If you have some anxiety about chemistry, you would really do well to get over that anxiety before taking this class, okay? And it's okay with me if you don't take chemistry class. It just means that you just have to apply yourself a little bit more at the beginning part of this course, right? So we can get over that. So pathophysiology right here means that there are some structural changes that take place in a person's body that changes their physiology. And it could be gross anatomy, it could be shapes of organelles, it could be shapes of proteins, could be shapes of different molecules inside the cell. Okay. All right, so another topic in this chapter is the scientific method. And we go over this a little bit. The scientific method has a number of steps in it. And the scientific method starts by a person just kind of walking around in their world looking at things and then just kind of seeing a repeated pattern over and over and over again. Okay, and then that person will say, well, you know, I have a guess about how the world operates and I'm really interested to see if it's true or not. So when somebody comes up with a guess about how the world operates, we call that a hypothesis. All right, so a hypothesis doesn't really have any importance about it. It just means that you were curious about something and how it behaves in the real world. And in order for a hypothesis to be part of the scientific method, it has to be a testable hypothesis. There are still some guesses that you might have, and you can't ever figure out how to test to see if it's true or if it's false. All right, like we could make a wild guess about something and say, I bet every person that standing in the parking lot, if they were to jump and they could jump on top of the building to the roof, they would always get an A in this anatomy class or physiology class. Anybody that can stand, jump onto the roof would get an A in physiology class. Okay, that's pretty wild, but could that be a scientific hypothesis? Could you ever test that? You know, I would say no, because you can't ever find anybody that can jump from the parking lot to the top of the building. So there's no way that you could test that hypothesis. And since you can't test it, it can't be part of the scientific method. All right? All right, so I don't want to get too much into philosophy in this class, but whenever you take a guess at something to be part of the scientific method, it has to be testable. Okay. And then after you test it, you get results from a test, you have to analyze the experiments, right? So you got to take careful notes and write numbers down, and it's very important to be able to make quantitative measurements about some kind of experiments that you are doing, right? And those quantitative measurements then can be used to prove or disprove this hypothesis right here. Then after you collect the information, right, and organize it, then you draw conclusions whether your results support the hypothesis or not. Okay, a lot of times you have to reject the hypothesis because the results don't support it. But if your results do confirm your hypothesis and other people can reproduce it in different parts of the world under different kinds of circumstances, then it can be developed into a theory. All right, so this whole page right here gives you a little bit of an outline of the scientific method, but what I really want you to take home is the difference between an hypothesis and a theory, right? Which is one that you can bet your life on? Is it a hypothesis or is it a theory? It's the theory, right? Don't forget, a hypothesis is just a guess. So a lot of times when you're out with your friends walking down the sidewalk and somebody says, oh, I have a theory about something. Let me tell you about this. What are they really telling you? They haven't done any experiments to see if it's true or not, right? They're telling you it's an hypothesis, right? But no one uses that word because it's so hard to pronounce, right? So a hypothesis is just kind of a guess based on some observations, right? But it might not really be true in many circumstances or all circumstances. So a theory is a general statement explaining the natural world, right, based on a proven hypothesis. So a theory should have much more importance to you compared to a hypothesis. Okay, so we said that for scientific method, it has to be tested. So when we test, if it's a scientific method for testing, we have at least two groups. All right, so we have an experimental group, and let's talk about maybe checking out the efficacy of some kind of drug treatment. So we'll have one group of patients, right, that will receive the active pharmaceutical agent or active drug, and then there's going to be another group of patients, and they should have the same maladies, right, but we give them a placebo, like a sugar pill or something that should have no pharmacological activity in them whatsoever. Do these two experiments at the same time and see indeed if the experimental group does show benefit to that treatment compared to control groups, right? Not to what you think a control group should be, but the actual control group. For instance, there are some drugs, like steroidal drugs, that don't dissolve in water. They're dissolved in oil, and sometimes a patient might need a shot of estrogen, which is a female sex hormone, and that's a steroid. It only dissolves in oil, not water. Okay, and so if we just give an oil shot to somebody, oil by itself has estrogenic properties, right? And so the control group has to get that oil shot without the estrogen to know what the effect of just the vehicle of administration is. Otherwise, you really don't know for sure if this experimental group is, if you're seeing the results due to the vehicle that estrogen is dissolved in, namely the oil or the active chemical estrogen. All right, so there's got to be experimental group and control group for it to be scientific method. All right, and then the measures should be quantitative with some kind of instrumentation that can be calibrated, right, and make sure it's working properly. And they have to be, these administrations of drugs have to be performed blindly. Now, what the heck does that mean? So we've got two control groups. They're both getting shots in the arm someplace, all right? But it's important that who's ever giving the shot doesn't know what patient is getting the placebo or the active agent. Because sometimes when somebody administers a drug, if they know what's happening, their facial expression will be different. They'll maybe take more care of the patient. Their attitudes will be different, and that might influence the results, right? So as the study is taking place, nobody should know what's going on. So that's what we mean by blindly. All right, and then after that, the data is collected and it's analyzed using systematic methods of statistics. All right, so all of the data will be analyzed the exact same way so that it can't be influenced by somebody's impression or how they want the results to turn out. Okay, so it's a little bit complicated. So the basic question here is a very important question, take-home information. What is the purpose of this scientific method? It's cumbersome. You got to have, and it's expensive, right? You got to have all these patients. You got to keep really good records, right? You got to hire all kinds of people to do it right. What's the purpose of the scientific method? This is really important. And maybe you haven't had time to think about this yet, but if you have an idea, go ahead and share it with us. What's the purpose of scientific method? The whole purpose for all of this extra work is to get reliable information. That's a really important take-home message. It is information that you can count on. And that's exactly what you want to have in your life, right? You don't want to get a bunch of information that you can't rely on. What do we call information that you can't rely on? Okay, kind of like a hypothesis, that's good, but it's what is noise, right? So you want to reduce noise in your life, and you want to suck in important information that will make meaningful changes to you, to keep you on a healthy path, or your grandma, or your grandpa, right, or your mom and dad, or kids, yeah.
So just to clear it up, the experimental, they're actually administered with the real drug, and the control is
Yeah, the experimental group gets the real drug. The control group gets everything exactly like the experimental group except that drug. So they have to have a shot, right? They still have to get stuck with a needle. And it's got to be in the same place in the body. And it's got to be the same volume of water or oil or whatever it is. Everything has got to be exactly identical, just minus that one thing. Okay. And the subject certainly don't know, and even the person that's giving the shot doesn't know. That's what we mean by blind. Okay, so even the person administering the experiment doesn't know what the expected results are. Okay, so the important thing is scientific method is cumbersome, all right? It's very professional method, but it gives you reliable information that you can trust your life with, right? Okay, so that's important. So the reason why I spent some time on this is because you're going to run into a lot of information in your textbook, and you're going to say, wow, this sounds like science fiction. This is really wild. Why am I studying this stuff? I can't imagine anybody relating to this. Well, everything in your textbook is not at the level of a hypothesis. Everything in your textbook is at the level of a theory. Right? So that information has been looked at by a number of groups. It's been published. It's been criticized. Right? And now it's all accepted as a theory. If I ever give you some information in class, which to me is a hypothesis, I'll tell you. I'll say, oh, this is my guess. And probably somebody's looking into it, but I don't know for sure. But my guess is that your body kind of functions this way or that way, or this might be good for you, might not be good for you. But it's not based on scientific information. There's a huge difference, right? There's a huge difference. Okay. But nonetheless, it's fun to think about how the world works and come up with hypotheses, right? So that right, you can eventually find important information for yourself. Okay, so let's change topics here a little bit, unless we got some more questions on scientific method. Yeah.
When does a theory become fact?
Well, facts would be things that you can, fact would be when you take a measurement of something. Okay, like if we draw somebody's blood, measure the pH of it, and if we know that's a good pH meter, it's working and calibrated properly and measure pH, maybe 7.3, something like that, then that's a fact. And it's even a better fact if we would repeat that measurement over a number of times. Okay, but so a fact is, okay, we drew blood one time, we measured the pH one time, and this is the pH number that we got. That's a fact. So we put all those facts together. If you really want to be sure about somebody's blood pH, you probably want to take numerous measurements over various times, maybe different times of the day. Okay, and then you have what? You have more facts, and now you know more about that person. But a fact is really not a theory. It's not an operational theory. Yeah, you have to collect facts, and all the facts should support the hypothesis. If your facts support the hypothesis, then it can become a theory that you can count on, okay, under certain circumstances. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's start talking about a really important and basic concept in physiology, and that is homeostasis. All right, and homeostasis just means how things stay the same, how same things stay the same. So this is a condition in which a lot of physiologic parameters inside your body, like blood pressure, pH that we were just talking about, body temperature, composition of fluids, or just the amount of fluids that you have in your body, and thousands of other factors of your internal environment, things that make you up inside, are maintained within a normal range of values. All right, so I suppose maybe you should think about your body temperature right now. Does it vary wildly? Or are you basically the same temperature all the time, whether it's cold outside or hot outside? Yeah, you're pretty much the same temperature because we're homeothermic organisms, right? We regulate our body temperature. So the important concept with homeostasis kind of means that our internal environment can be a lot different than the outside environment. Right? The outside right now is not 98.6. Our internal environment is. So we're different than the outside world, a lot different. And it has to remain that way for you to stay alive. Right? If you get way overheated, what do we call that when you get way overheated? Hyperthermia. Or you can get too cold. That's hypothermia. Right? And those both are life-threatening conditions. And you have to be around 98.6. But here is the important, a little bit more complicated idea with homeostasis. Homeostasis doesn't mean that your body temperature is exactly 98.6 every second of your life, right? It can change. It can go up a little bit. Maybe it can go down a little bit. And so we say that it's a dynamic state, that it changes, right? It changes a little bit, but not drastically. And so it changes where all the body systems are working together to constantly adjust to the changing internal and external conditions. So homeostasis means that you should have a certain level of fluid in your body so that you don't become dehydrated. Probably more people in the world die of dehydration than anything else, right, due to drinking contaminated water or food, right, and they have diarrhea and they dehydrate, so that's a really important consideration. If you become dehydrated, you get beyond the conditions suitable to support life. Now, when you get hyperthermic, how does your body temperature go back to where it should? What else changes in your body? You start sweating, so you lose fluids as a result. So that brings your body temperature back down. So your body temperature isn't constant. The fluid levels in your body are not constant, but they're always kind of dancing around each other so that those two parameters don't go beyond the normal limits and cause problems for you. Okay, so homeostasis doesn't mean absolutely constant or different than the environment. It means that your physiologic parameters are changing all the time to adjust for other changes that are happening inside your body. All right, let's look and see how that happens a little bit. So there are a number of control systems or control mechanisms inside your body, and one of the things that we're going to look at first are signaling molecules. So these are chemicals that can move in your body through various means. Some are by diffusion, some get into your blood and are transported by the blood, and some are very short range, but the ones that we're looking at right here are long range reflexes. Okay, and so this particular figure is not in your book, but it's in the PowerPoint slides and it's in your exam study guide. So this is a possible exam figure, even though it's not in your book. So you have it as a test question as well. Here is the key to help answer that, even though it's not in your book. So here we have a single cell. It's producing a product that it secretes from the cell. There's some secretory pathway. Anybody remember some organelles maybe involved with a secretory pathway inside the cell right here? There's got to be something like rough endoplasmic reticulum that makes a protein, and then it goes into the Golgi body where it's modified and packaged into a secretory vesicle, and then it hops a ride on a microtubule over to the plasma membrane where it fuses with the plasma membrane, and then that product is secreted outside the cell. All right, so it gets outside the cell, and then it can be picked up by the blood in this blood vessel, and once it's in the blood vessel, where does it go? Everywhere. Everywhere in your body, wherever blood goes to. There's some tissues that don't have blood vessels, like epithelium, okay, but most tissues have blood. How does this hormone get into a blood vessel? What kind of blood vessel can take up this hormone? This is just a nice trick question from anatomy. Based on the structure, there's only certain blood vessels that can take up chemicals, and that is a capillary. That's right. Arteries and veins can't exchange with their environment because arteries and veins are way too thick, way too many layers, right? But capillaries just have a simple squamous endothelium. It's a thin layer, so chemicals can diffuse across through a capillary. So this hormone gets absorbed by a capillary, gets into a blood vessel, right? Say into a vein. Now, can it leave that vein? It's stuck. It can only leave the blood when it gets to another capillary someplace, right? Because that's the only place where things can exchange. So it gets to a target organ or a target cell where there are capillaries, it leaves, and then this hormone can tell this cell to change its physiology, change its behavior somehow. So now this cell, the gland cell that's secreting the hormone, can exert a control over this target cell right here. We're going to look in a lot of detail of those things. So if you have a signaling molecule that gets secreted by a cell and gets delivered everywhere in the body by a blood vessel, we call that a hormone. And the cells that produce that hormone are called endocrine glands. Endocrine glands don't have any ducts, right? Because they don't have to secrete this hormone into a duct to get anywhere because it has the vascular system to deliver it. All right, so that can happen all over your body. That's why it's a long-range reflex. All right, here is information passing from a nerve cell to another nerve cell. And this chemical compound right? If it goes to a neighboring nerve cell right here, so from one neuron over here to another neuron or effector cell right here, right, we call that a neurotransmitter. So it's a signaling molecule that's secreted by a neuron. So that's a neurotransmitter. Other neurons can secrete something that gets put into the extracellular space, but it's taken up by a capillary. All right, so here is a chemical secreted by a neuron. So we can think of this model right here. What would you like to call that? A neurotransmitter, right? But it gets absorbed by the blood and distributed throughout your whole body. Okay, so it has also a feature of a hormone. Right, so well, we have to expand our terminology and say, well, that's really not a neurotransmitter because it's acting like a hormone, but it's not just a hormone because it's really a neurotransmitter. So what is it? It's a neurohormone. So we have to combine those two terms together. Right, so it's a little bit more sophisticated understanding of how signaling molecules work. Okay, so make sure you can label that. This is an exam figure as well. All right, so but instead of long-term signaling, right, from maybe your brain down to your kneecap someplace, this is very short range within, right, just a distance of a cell or a couple cells, where we have a cell that produces a product, secretes it outside the cell, and it moves by diffusion to this target cell, doesn't go into the blood, but the cell right next to it, that's what we call a paracrine agent, a paracrine, right? But if this agent that is secreted by the cell, right, binds to something on the same cell surface that secreted it and changes the behavior of the cell on the inside, that's what we call an autocrine. All right, so an autocrine will affect the cell that secretes it. It changes the behavior of the cell that secretes it. All right, so these terms get a little bit complicated because what about this neurotransmitter right here? It goes to a neighboring cell. A neurotransmitter is also a paracrine agent. Okay, so sometimes these things can be used together. It all just depends. Okay, so homeostasis. So those molecules are used to maintain homeostasis. Don't forget, homeostasis doesn't mean everything is absolutely constant. It means things are changing all the time. So homeostasis is a condition where everything is stabilized or one particular parameter is stabilized above or below some physiologic set point. So let's look at this little diagram right here. Here we have, and this could be blood pressure, this could be temperature, this could be pH, right, or fluid level inside your body, or any number of thousands of different physiologic parameters. The solid line right here is the absolute normal value, right? If we were to measure every person in the world, that's the number that we would come up with, right? And we call that the set point. That's what every human body is desiring to have operating in their body. So for temperature, that would be 98.6 degrees. Okay, but if you start exercising, your body temperature goes up. Okay, so here we see body temperature going up. But now when the temperature is elevated, there are other physiologic mechanisms that become activated, like sweating, and what does that do? That cools your body down. Okay, and then when you get cold, what happens to your sweating? You stop sweating. Maybe if you're really cold, you start shivering. What happens to your body temperature? It starts to go back up. So your body temperature is fluctuating above and below this set point all the time, but you're healthy as long as this variation right here doesn't go beyond this normal range. If it goes beyond the normal range, then that's a disease state. So this is homeostasis right here. Not absolutely constant. That's just kind of a figment of our imagination. It's what? It's this variation in that parameter. And the parameter will always have a tendency to move back to the set point, either down to the set point if it's too high or up to the set point if it's too low, when it uses negative feedback mechanisms or negative feedback loops. So this term negative has a bad connotation to it, but in terms of control system theory, a negative feedback mechanism does what? Maintains homeostasis by making sure these parameters stay within a normal range, right? So negative feedback usually produces a non-pathological healthy state. So let's diagram this just a little bit differently. This figure is in your book as well. Okay, so let's look at this top figure right here. Actually, you know what? I want to look at this one. This is the one that's not in your book. So this is the one everybody has to memorize, for the quiz. But if you don't memorize it for the quiz this week, you got to memorize it for the test. And if you don't memorize it for the test, you should memorize it just for the rest of your life anyway. Okay, it's really important. Okay, so here is a response loop. And there might be a change in your body. Maybe your temperature goes up. We're going to call that a stimulus. And your body will recognize that stimulus if you have a receptor for it. Okay, another receptor would be light. I can turn all the lights off in the room, and then I can turn it on, and that will be a stimulus for you if you have what? Eyes that are functioning, right? You have to have a receptor for light, so your elbow won't sense it, right? You have photoreceptors in your retina. All right, so the second feature of a response loop is that you have to have a functioning receptor for that modality of energy. If it's a change in pH, you have to have what? A pH meter someplace, something that measures hydrogen ions. And there are pH meters in our brains that do that for us. All right, and then the sensor has to share that information. It sends it out through a pathway to the integration center. So this pathway that is taking information in, for instance, maybe to the hypothalamus or to the medulla oblongata, we call that is taking information from the periphery into the brain. That is an afferent nerve, right, or an afferent nerve. That is just terminology we used in anatomy. And that integration center has the set point. It knows what the perfect value should be. So it compares the information from the stimulus, it subtracts it from the stimulus to see if it's the same or different, right? So we call that analysis. It looks at the stimulus, compares it to the set point in the integration center, and then it makes a decision. If the information is exactly at the set point, what's the decision to do? For instance, yeah, if we go back to this diagram right here, so if the body is measuring temperature and it's right here at the set point level, what's the integration center going to do? Absolutely nothing, because everything is perfect just as it is. If it makes a change, it's going to drive it away from the set point. Okay. All right, so a good question would be on exam, what part of a response loop has the set point located in it? And that is the integration center. All right, and you'll learn some various integration centers in your body. So it analyzes the information, then makes a decision what to do. But if your environment is different than the set point, the decision is to change something about your body. So it sends information from the central nervous system to the periphery. What kind of nerve takes information from the CNS into the periphery? That is an efferent nerve, right? That's an efferent nerve. So here we have the efferent pathway. It takes it to an effector. So for instance, if you're cold, that effector is going to be a skeletal muscle that's going to contract, right? And it's going to produce some heat, all right? So that raises your body temperature. That increase in body temperature is what we call a response. So some questions would be, how does the response loop always start? What does it always start with? Stimulus, and what does it always end with? A response, really nice and easy to see on this diagram, and the response will always feed back to the stimulus. And if the response adds to the stimulus, this is really important, if it adds to it, we call that a positive feedback loop. So for instance, if the stimulus was an increase in body temperature, if it's positive feedback, that would mean that something was happening to increase your body temperature, which would add to the stimulus, which would make it even warmer, right? And if it's still maintained as a positive feedback loop, what would happen to your body temperature? It would get higher and higher and higher and higher until, well, then it's too bad what would happen, right? That would be positive feedback, not a good thing. If it's negative feedback, it means then this response is going to cool your body down and it's going to subtract from the stimulus. And since the response subtracts from the stimulus, we call that negative feedback. That's going to drive your body temperature back to the set point, and that's going to produce a normal body temperature. It's maintaining homeostasis. So that's why negative feedback loops, when response subtracts from the stimulus, right, it allows that parameter to move back down to the set point. Yeah. Yes, there are a number, and every time we talk about one in this class, I want you to make special note of it, because they're so rare, but they're so important. There are normal everyday occurrences where positive feedback is important, And I want you to be familiar with those. I have a little list at the end of this chapter, like coagulation, blood clotting is important. There's a big LH surge that causes ovulation in the ovulatory cycle of women, which is important. That's a positive feedback mechanism. Even parturition, even a baby when it's born, is due to a positive feedback mechanism. Okay, so there's a number of important. There's some electrical events that happen inside people that are positive feedback that are very important for normal physiology, but they only operate over the short term, short period of time. And even nursing, milk letdown is due to a positive feedback mechanism. Yes, question? Yeah. Pathophysiology, maybe 15 years ago, we didn't think could be transferred from one generation to another. But now we do know there are things that we term epigenetics. And it means that somebody can modify their DNA by their behavior or by taking various chemicals. And that can affect that person's DNA, not at the base pairing level, but at different levels of chemical associations associated with DNA that they can pass on to their offspring. So yes, things that you do in your life can affect your offspring. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's interesting. Come on down after class. We can talk about that a little bit. That's really interesting. It's a, just a new burgeoning field, but it's interesting to see how other things than just DNA. All right, so we're done with lecture for today. Okay, I want to see the sign-in sheet. Who's got the sign-in sheet? All right, thank you. So see you in lab at 1 o'clock. Or if not, then maybe I'll see you on Tuesday. Okay, see you. Thank you.